famed English author Virginia Woolf. This is the only, it's a segment from the only existing recording of her voice. She is, of course, a seminal essayist and thinker and feminist and author from the early part of the 20th century. This recording was originally broadcast in April 1937, part of a longer interview. This is just a clip of it, but it's a significant clip. And let's give it a listen here. This is Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf.
It is them we hear. It is them we see. Only after the writer is dead do his words to some extent, only to some extent, become disinfected, purified of the accidents of the living body. Now, this power of suggestion is one of the most exciting and most mysterious properties of words. Most exciting if you are a person in the habit of using them. Everyone who has ever written a sentence must be conscious or half conscious of it. Words, English words, are full of echoes, memories, associations, naturally. They've been out and about on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing in today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they have contracted so many famous marriages in the past. The splendid word incarnadine, for example, who can use that without remembering multitudinous seas? In the old days, of course, when English was a new language, writers could invent new words and use them. Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation. But we cannot use them because the English language is old. You cannot use a brand new word in an old language because of the very obvious, yet always mysterious fact that a word is not a single and separate entity. It is part of other words. Indeed, it is not a word until it is part of a sentence. Words belong to each other. Although, of course, only a great poet knows that the word incarnadine belongs to multitudinous seas. To combine new words with old words is fatal to the constitution of the sentence. In order to use new words properly, you would have to invent a whole new language. And that, though no doubt we shall come to it, is not at the moment our business. Our business is to see what we can do with the old English language as it is. How can we combine the old words in new orders so that they survive, so that they create beauty, so that they tell the truth? That is the question. And the person who could answer that question would deserve whatever crown of glory the world has to offer. Think what it would mean if you could teach or if you could learn the art of writing. Why, every book, every newspaper you pick up would tell the truth or would create beauty. But there is, it would appear, some obstacle in the way, some hindrance to the teaching of words. For though at this moment at least 100 professors lecturing on the literature of the past, at least 1,000 critics are reviewing the literature of the present, and hundreds upon hundreds of young men and women are passing examinations in English literature with the utmost credit, still, do we write better? Do we read better than we read and wrote 400 years ago when we were unlectured, uncriticized, untaught? Is our modern Georgian literature a patch on the Elizabethan? Well, where are we to lay the blame? Not on our professors, not on our reviewers, not on our writers, but on words. It is words that are to blame. They are the wildest, freest, most irresponsible, most unteachable of all things. Of course, you can catch them and sort them and place them in alphabetical order in dictionaries. But words do not live in dictionaries. They live in the mind. If you want proof of this, consider how often, in moments of emotion, when we most need words, we find none. Yet there is a dictionary. There at our disposal are some 500,000 words, all in alphabetical order. But can we use them? No, because words do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind. Look once more at the dictionary. There, beyond a doubt, lie plays more splendid than Antony and Cleopatra, poems lovely on the ode to a nightingale, novels beside which Pride and Prejudice or David Copperfield are the crude bunglings of amateurs. It's only a question of finding the right words and putting them in the right order. We can't do it because they do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind. And how do they live in the mind? Variously and strangely, much as human beings live, ranging hither and thither, falling in love, meeting together. It is true they are much less bound by ceremony and convention than we are. Royal words meet with commoners. English words marry French words, German words, Indian words, Negro words, if they have a fancy. Indeed, the less we inquire into the past of our dear mother English, the better it will be for that lady's reputation, for she has gone a roving fair maid. Thus, to lay down any laws for such irreclaimable vagabonds is worse than useless. A few trifling rules of grammar and spelling is all the constraint we can put on them. All we can say about them as we peer at them over the edge of that deep, dark, and only fitfully illuminated cavern in which they live, the mind, all we can say about them is that they seem to like people to think before they use them and to feel before they use them. But to think and to feel not about them, about something different. They are highly sensitive, easily made self-conscious. They do not like to have their purity or their impurity discussed. If you start a society for pure English, they will show their resentment by starting another for impure English. Hence the unnatural violence of much modern speech, the protest against the Puritans. They are highly democratic, too. They believe that one word is as good as another. Uneducated words, as good as educated words. Uncultivated words, as good as cultivated words. There are no ranks or titles in their society. Nor do they like being lifted on the point of a pen and examined separately. They hang together in sentences, paragraphs, sometimes for whole pages at a time. Then they hate being useful. They hate making money. They hate being lectured about in public. In short, they hate anything that stamps them with one meaning or confines them to one attitude, for it is their nature to change. Perhaps that is our most striking peculiarity, their need of change. It is because the truth they try to catch is many-sided, and they convey it by being many-sided, flashing first this way, then that. Thus they mean one thing to one person, another thing to another person. They are unintelligible to one generation, plain as a pikestaff to the next. And it is because of this complexity, this power to mean different things to different people, that they survive. Perhaps then one reason why we have no great poet, novelist, or critic writing today is that we refuse to allow words their liberty. We pin them down to one meaning, their useful meaning, the meaning which makes us catch the train, the meaning which makes us pass the examination.
Virginia Woolf, author and essayist and feminist. That was the only existing recording of her voice from a radio broadcast in 1937, part of a series released by the British Library and the BBC, a three CD collection of interviews and spoken parts from famous British authors. And we may visit this one again. It's got a lot of interesting little clips in there. All right, we're going to go on with the show. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. And next up is one of our favorites, Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Giant owls once walked the earth. As recently as 10,000 years ago, these owls, now extinct, were among the largest of all known owls, standing 3.5 feet tall and weighing 20 pounds. They thrived among the top predators on the island of Cuba. But the wings of the Cuban giant owl were surprisingly small. They may have powered the bird up to low perches, but scientists think it hunted primarily on foot. Running on long, powerful legs, equipped with large talons, the bird ambushed or chased down its prey. The owls appear to have evolved their remarkable size and ground-dwelling habits at a time when Cuba had no large carnivorous mammals to compete with. Very little is known about why they died out. Fossils of similar owls, with long legs and small wings, have been unearthed in places as disparate as Hawaii and Georgia, pointing to large terrestrial owls as a widespread, successful adaptation. But from any angle, the Cuban giant owl was a behemoth among owls, an example of evolution pushed to the extreme. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Want more Bird Note sounds, images, and stories delivered straight to your inbox? Subscribe to our weekly newsletter for a preview of the week's shows, stories, and stunning photos every Friday morning. Visit birdnote.org to sign up today.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.
My best and most healthy relationship snuck up on me. I was in my late teens and started the relationship thinking I'd have a summer fling and maybe learn a little bit about dating in the process. I told myself, I'll dump him in September when school starts again. And then I ended up falling in love with him. We were together 5.5 years. Since then, I've had a string of relationships where the driving force was passion. It starts out strong with a blast of wild intensity and an all-encompassing fervor, but they end up being emotionally unavailable. I wanted to know what was happening and found some answers in attachment theory, which is research on the types of people we're attracted to and what happens when we get together. After delving into the attachment research, I started to purposefully date people who were better for me, but this came with much less excitement and passion. I found the process a little discouraging and a bit overwhelming. Dating like this was new territory. I became interested in doing a story on dating differently. I was curious about how this worked for others, and then I happened to bump into Mark at a party. He had gone through something similar, and he was willing to share his story. Mark and Eileen were set up by a couple of friends, and it was a bit awkward at first.
It was kind of a strange thing. It's, you know, when your parents tell you to talk to their friend's kid, it felt a bit like that, kind of a forced conversation.
As Mark will say, he felt obligated to talk to me.
Regardless, they ended up staying up most of the night and even took in the sunrise together. But it wasn't an instant connection. They went out a couple more times, but they didn't really pursue each other. After some prodding from friends on both sides, they start to date a bit more consistently.
In the beginning, I have to say part of it was that I kept thinking to myself, Mark's kind of crazy and he does all these wild things, but like he has very down-to-earth, lovely friends. And that was kind of like a stabilizing factor where I was like, you know what, I'm going to like see what's going on with this guy. Because I felt like he had some great characteristics. We had a lot of fun together. We had some stuff in common, but there were certain things like the lack of commitment and other things that would drive me a bit crazy.
Things like Mark finding it hard to commit to any plans with Eileen in case something better came along, or about how she'd barely see Mark when they went to parties together because he'd be off socializing and only realize he hadn't spoken to her all night when she'd find him to say goodnight. And these were the early days where you might expect just the opposite.
It was like pretty early on, like it must have been at like about a month or something. And I just said very casually to Mark, how do you think things are going? Which I thought was like a very normal question to ask someone that you had dated a bunch of times and seen a couple times a week for a month. And he like took this long pause and then he was like, well, I'd say I'm about 60% into you.
In my mind, I tend to think in terms of, I guess, too much like an engineer. And so I was tried to explain my rationale in terms of the way I'd been thinking previously about relationships starting at 100% and only dwindling. So trying to explain to her that, you know, I'm not at 100%, but it's increasing.
And I was so taken aback because first, definitely wasn't expecting a number. Like, I had not expected him to like quantify it in numerical form. Secondly, I felt like 60 seemed like really low.
It's on the right side of 50% was what I was thinking. And it was only going to increase from there.
And he seemed like pretty delighted with this. And then he followed up by, no, well, it started way lower. I mean, I don't think like I'm an egoist, but at the same time, I don't feel like, you know, I need to be at a place where it's like, oh, well, look what the cat dragged in. Like, you know, I was also someone who's used to being a fairly high achiever. And to me, like 60 didn't seem that good. And I didn't really want to like know that. But that kind of speaks to Mark's like brutal honesty. He'll just say it like it is, you know?
Most of Mark's previous relationships started off quite differently. He was swept away by excitement and passion. They'd hook up and fall into relationship within a week's time, but they didn't last long.
I kind of notoriously had like a 3-month limit for my relationships and then would move on.
This is where attachment theory might come in handy. It's a psychological model that attempts to describe the dynamics of long and short-term relationships between humans. It's actually really accurate at predicting how people will behave in romantic relationships and whether they'll be matched based on their attachment styles. I found it immensely illuminating in my own life. It gave some context to the pattern I started to become aware of, one of being attracted to emotionally unavailable men and also being somewhat turned off people who were just the opposite and were available and present. Considering I've been a therapist for 10 years, you could say I came upon this info embarrassingly late, but I guess it's always easier to see what's happening in someone else's life than your own. There are 4 attachment types. People with a secure attachment are warm and loving. Relationships come easily to them, and they're great at communicating their needs and feelings. They're also comfortable with intimacy and independence. They're like the gold standard. People with an anxious attachment tend to be stressed out about their relationships. They love being very close to their partners, and they have the capacity for a lot of intimacy. However, they need a lot of reassurance and affection. People with an avoidant attachment style are fiercely independent and are often uncomfortable with intimacy. For them, the idea of commitment can be scary. They often construct their lifestyle in order to avoid commitment or too much intimate contact. So even though they want to be in relationship, they tend to keep their distance. The last attachment style is the combination of anxious and avoidant. With this type, the person is uncomfortable with intimacy and commitment, and at the same time, they have a strong desire to be in relationship. So how exactly do these attachment styles develop? They're actually formed through interactions with our parents as infants. Mark's 3-month relationships unfolded in relatively the same way. The first month was fun and full of passion. The second month, as Mark put it, they'd be coasting. And by the 3rd month, things already started to feel a bit old. No longer in the honeymoon phase, he would get antsy and bored. Small superficial things that his partner did would start to annoy him.
It was really silly. It was just like wearing the same ratty pants over and over. It was just something that I noticed that stood out. No longer kind of this perfect image that I had of the person.
Through the attachment theory lens, our reactions to our partner's small imperfections would be seen as an avoidant type's distancing reaction to the idea of commitment. And this can all happen subconsciously.
And that's where I noticed also that it wasn't so much about the person, but it was also about me and how I approached the relationships. I realized if I want to have a relationship that lasted longer than 3 months, I needed to learn to appreciate those things and be able to accept how a person is. I think it was just realizing that after seeing that pattern numerous times, that it wasn't sustainable and this can't be how you build a long-term relationship.
I asked Mark and Eileen to read over a summary on attachment styles to see where they identified themselves on the attachment spectrum.
Maybe Eileen can answer better for me.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. He definitely started out with feeling uncomfortable when things are too close and intimate and valuing independence and freedom. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This is like classic. Mark is always surprised when I say something that I think is like completely obvious. I'll be like, oh, well, Mark really likes, you know, chicken. He's like, chicken? What do you mean I like chicken?
I guess I don't see myself in any boxes. So when someone sees me in a box, I'm always surprised by it.
Mark's reaction is understandable. Even though we may have a dominant attachment style, it's on a spectrum. So in most cases, we can have a bit of all styles in varying quantities. I take a guess that Mark would fall into the avoidant category. And Eileen sounds like a mixture of anxious and secure. You can see it playing out, where Mark's more distant at first, and Eileen's looking for reassurance while still remaining grounded. I'm simplifying this all a bit, but you get it. There are predictable ways that the different attachment types tend to configure themselves into relationships. Secure types are capable of dating both anxious and avoidant types. They're comfortable enough with themselves to give anxious types all the reassurance they need and to give avoidant types the space they need without feeling threatened themselves. But opposites also attract. Anxious types are drawn to avoidant types and vice versa. For anxious types, avoidant types validate their abandonment fears and an insecurity of not being enough. In turn, avoidant types need someone to pursue them to meet the emotional needs that they subconsciously disown. I learned through my research that I was stuck in what's called the anxious-avoidant trap. I was the anxious one in this scenario. It was explained that I was attracted to avoidant types because they activated my attachment system. The attachment system is needed for survival. It's the system responsible for babies attaching to their caregivers. And it's the same system working in romantic relationships. So as an anxious person, getting mixed messages from an avoidant type and the tension that can arise from that activates the attachment system, which puts the person into overdrive to make the relationship work. And the feeling created in that reaction can get mixed up for feelings of like or love. And the other hard part is that if an anxious type meets someone who's secure and much better suited, the attachment system doesn't get activated. There's less drama, which can cause feelings of boredom. So if you're an anxious type, there's a good chance you'll automatically interpret calmness in the relationship as lack of attraction.
I would say Mark is like very comfortable with intimacy, and I'd say that you don't obsess where the relationship's going or my ability to love you back. I would say he's moved towards this.
Meaning secure attachment.
For me, I would probably have started out more with like having some insecurity about where the relationship was going, and some of the things Mark did like really setting me off and driving me crazy. So more in the anxious and then gone more into the secure. We started in different boxes but ended up in the same one.
And that's exactly what can happen. Our attachment styles aren't fixed, thank goodness. They may lead us astray at points, but it's possible to develop a secure attachment at any age. Change occurs mostly when you get into a relationship that really shakes your beliefs about love. If, for example, you expect people to let you down or reject you once they get to know the real you, and then you meet someone who's supportive and loving no matter what, over time, you'll likely become more secure. So even though we don't have control over the type of attachment style that gets formed in infancy, we're not doomed.
I think I remember the turning point there. It was a discussion where we had where, I guess a lot of couples have that, their like first fight, but then realizing that the person's going to stick through it. And I think that's where things probably kind of changed. Whereas in my previous relationships, it would have been like, okay, time to move on. Whereas this then was like, oh, okay, well, even if things are rough, this person's going to stick it out and we'll figure it out and work through it. I guess it just, for me, was not a pattern that I had been used to in my previous relationships. And so knowing that having a fight wasn't the end of the relationship was, I think, a really positive thing.
What was it that showed you, hey, this isn't going to be the end of us?
I think it was her reaction saying, you know, that we're not breaking up. Just even hearing that was a very good thing for me to hear. And I'm holding her to it now. And now we're at the point where I like talking about things a lot more than Eileen does.
Yeah, Mark's an excellent communicator.
I have to admit, I was disappointed by their story, even a bit bored. Was that it? No big ups and downs, no big revelations, just two people growing together and finally realizing their opposite traits are complementary. And then I realized I was still chasing excitement, if not through my own story, but through others. And it's not about excitement. It's about companionship, which can still involve excitement. Mark and Eileen have tons of fun together. They play, they joke. They're cool folks. In my own life, trying to break the pattern hasn't been easy. I've come up with the term dating in the middle to describe my experience. I'm trying not to run after fireworks, but I also need to feel something. So I guess that's the middle. But it's all still pretty new. When I meet someone nice and attractive enough, who I might not feel wildly excited about, I think, give this a chance. But also, I keep reminding myself that distance is my kryptonite. I think danger, stay away, but I'm still pulled towards it. It's not easy out there, especially when my compass has been stuck pointing north to emotionally unavailable men for years. It's going to take some time getting comfortable dating differently, but I think it might be worth it.
Part of my philosophy now in terms of being in a long committed relationship and my fear of missing out, you know, is that this is a great opportunity to have this lifelong commitment to someone. And if I'm not faithful, it will actually ruin that. And that's what I'm going to be missing out. I'd be missing out on a lifelong partner and building a life together with someone. And so it's just kind of turning it around, kind of using my weaknesses as a strength.
And so how many years in now?
11.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're close to 100% now, too.
I hope you enjoyed that presentation. That was a documentary created by CJSF Radio as part of a grant we got from the Canadian Radio Fund of Canada, or Community Radio Fund of Canada. All right, we are just about out of time here at Speak Up for today's program. Coming up, I just want to remind you about a giveaway we have. We talked about it on yesterday's show. Two tickets to Early Music Vancouver and the Vancouver Chamber Choir's presentation of Handel's Messiah at the Orpheum Theatre on December 8th. We have two tickets to give away, and you can get in the running for those tickets by emailing cjsfae@sfu.ca, and we'll choose the winners this Friday, and hopefully that will be you. So email your interest and why you'd like to go to that show. All right, that is the end of the program for today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to finish off this program with this from a track from Faith Healer. This is The Game from their most recent album. Thanks for listening to Speak Up. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right after this.
Tethered to the world becomes a tangle. It gets shorter every angle that you take. You can keep yourself alive without your tether in exile, but the breeze will still remind you of the game. So safe, it's like an anchor, and it holds you in its arm, and you feel safe. So you shied from sacrifice, your tether and your will collide. They don't fight, they just become one.